Good evening. For those I haven't met, I'm Mordechai Torchiner. Thank you very much for coming this evening. I want to thank Shamayim Adult Education as well for enabling us to have the class tonight. There are sign-in sheets. There are three of them. If anyone knows where they are, can you just like raise your hand and let me know? Okay, there's at least one over there, another one back there. Please make sure that you do sign in, especially if you want to have credit for it. If you want us to be able to answer the Law Society, yes, you are here, we need to know that. If you have, by some chance, a cell phone with you, if you could please put it on vibrate, silent, whatever mode will not distract people, that would be great. The class is approved for 1.5 professionalism credits by the Law Society, which means that we are going to run about 1.5 hours. And our topic is, as you see at the top of the sheets, sell yourself, ethical advertising of legal services. It was a fun topic to work on. One book that I use that I highly recommend in general for issues of business ethics that can overlap with legal ethics is the one I have listed at the top of the sheets. Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, who passed away a few years ago, I had the chance to get to know him a little bit. He wrote Moral Issues of the Marketplace in Jewish Law. It's a very readable book, and it deals with issues like this and items that are broader as well. What I'm not going to deal with under the heading of ethical advertising is the plain issue of obeying the law when you advertise. I'm sort of taking it as a given that we understand that you have to obey the law when you advertise. So, you know, an example is one that was noted to me beforehand about, organizations do this. I imagine individuals end up doing this, businesses end up doing it as well, which is inappropriate use of somebody's trademark copyrighted property. As in, if you're advertising an event and it happens to allow the Maple Leafs, that doesn't mean you get to put their logo on your materials, that sort of thing. So I'm kind of assuming that that's straightforward. Yes, you're obligated to obey the law, and ignorance is no excuse. What I do want to deal with are the gray areas in ethics. If you take a look at source number one, this was very timely. We actually set these up like back in June, July, and at that point get the permission from the Law Society and everything. But sometimes issues come to a head in a timely way, and that's the case with this. The article from the Law Times, source number one on the sheets, Law Society zeroes in on lawyer advertising. It appeared on January 11th. In the early summer of 2015, Convocation agreed to a call for input on potential changes to its existing regulations on advertising, giving legal professionals until this past October to comment. Malcolm Mercer, chair of the LSUC Professional Regulation Committee, says the call for input stemmed mainly from concern by some lawyers and benchers about the proliferation of advertising in the personal injury realm in recent years. I'm not going to ask who does personal injury here. There were concerns expressed simply about the volume of it, but there was also concern expressed about the nature of the advertising, and some of that goes to the professionalism of the content, Mercer says. Another issue that came up is the substance of what is being said in ads. Some respondents say there are claims being made in advertising that shouldn't be made, such as potentially misleading claims about awards. He said lawyers have also complained that some advertising suggests a lawyer is particularly aggressive or will take a hard-nosed adversarial approach. I'm pretty sure I've heard a few of those on the radio. Mercer adds another interesting point raised by some legal professionals is advertising that, quote, tends to lower the public confidence in the legal system is a problem in and of itself. Just out of curiosity, do you think people's perception of the legal profession is influenced heavily by the advertising? I'm not a lawyer. I am married to one. I found that a little bit of a reach. And we're actually going to touch on that a little bit later. But I thought that the Law Society actually did a pretty good job of expressing clearly what the rules are for ethical advertising. And you'll see, we're going to get to Rule 4.2, which does present a clear description of what is considered inappropriate. Nonetheless, what we're going to see is that it's not such a simple matter because there is a tension between poles when it comes to legal advertising. It's not simple and straightforward. What are the reasons in favor of encouraging, in fact, encouraging legal advertising? In other words, encouraging the advertising of legal services. Yeah?
For example, whatever advertises, people will see exactly what area of law they practice.
Okay. So you're saying clarity for the consumer.
Right.
People will have greater information. Good. What else? Why is it that we want lawyers to be able to advertise? I'm not speaking about the fact that lawyers need to be able to earn a living, but separate from that, what's the value to society when lawyers are able to advertise their services? Yeah? Right. Access to justice. You're going to say that also. Access to justice. The idea that citizens are supposed to be able to avail themselves of a legal system, and if they don't have the information, if they don't know where to go, then they're stuck. So it's actually a public service. We need that advertising. So there is, on the one hand, access to justice, as well as, also part of this issue, ensuring fair markets. Making sure that not only will they know what's available, but that they'll be able to do some kind of comparison. They know multiple options, and they can do some type of comparison between their options. That's on the side of advertising. On the other hand, there are challenges when it comes to advertising, and that's what we're going to talk about, the concerns for misleading advertising, the concerns for, we'll talk about what those are. That's what we're here for. But if you take a look at source number 2, I gave you a list of 4 cases, and I think we have more people here now than we had source sheets printed, which means I'm guessing that some people don't have the sheets. If you're able to look on with someone else, that's good. Everybody who signs in will also get a copy of it digitally. I'll send that out, I hope, tonight or tomorrow, so you'll be able to have it that way too. But take a look at the cases in number 2. First case, Bird and Dog LLP advertises will preparation services, but actually refers all clients to other firms in exchange for referral fees. Bird and Dog LLP appropriately discloses the fee to the client. So in other words, there's no question about impropriety in taking the referral fee. Everything is done above board. The client is aware of it. That piece of it is fine. May Bird and Dog LLP advertise legal services without disclosing this arrangement? Does the ad have to say, we will refer you to somebody else? Or is it acceptable for them to simply advertise, we deal in will preparation? What would you say?
They have to disclose.
We have a have to disclose here, yeah?
I would say in the ad, no, but before the transaction actually goes ahead, they have to disclose.
In the ad, no, but when someone is going to retain them, in other words. Okay. Others? So that's one of the cases we're going to have to see. We're going to need to discuss this question, and for each of these questions, we're going to look at it from 2 sides. We're going to look at it from the perspective of the Law Society, and we're going to look at it also from the perspective of Jewish ethics and Jewish law, and what the expectations are for both. And what we're going to find is that while the two systems are pretty closely aligned on most issues, they're not aligned on every issue. There are some areas in which the Law Society will say, you can't do that. And Jewish law will say, well, we had no problem with it, or vice versa. But that's case number 1. Case number 2. Low-end price LLP's marketing slogan is, we will beat anyone's hourly fee to draft your will. Is this an acceptable form of marketing? We got no's. Why isn't it? What's wrong with it? Yeah.
Well, it's very misleading, so it intends to want to think they're going to get the cheapest round, but in fact, it's hourly rates that they're talking about. They're not talking about the total rate.
Right.
And they put in more hours to prepare the will.
Right. They're not actually telling you how many hours will be involved. There's an element that's misleading. Let's say you took that out. Let's say they capped it. And they said, we will beat everyone's hourly rate, and we will do it over a, I don't know what, 10-hour, 15-hour, whatever it is. As someone who doesn't prepare wills, I have no idea what the right number is. But let's say they cap it with a reasonable number of hours as well. Then what would you say? Yeah? So that's an interesting question. Are we allowed to be capitalists? Right? Am I allowed to take someone else's livelihood away by advertising in this way? Well, if not, then maybe I shouldn't go into business at all. Right? Or maybe I should just go into business and not be good at it. That would be an option. We will not beat everybody else's hourly rate. That's a winning slogan. Yes?
A savvy consumer on this type of ad would tell me personally that pay peanuts and get monkeys.
Right. The class that's the question is, when you see an ad that says, we are going to give you the lowest price, does that perhaps translate in your mind to, you're going to get the lowest quality? Right? My car, when I have to bring in the car, so I bring it into the dealer, and on the shelf, sort of behind where all the agents are sitting, they have a big sign that tells you how much it would cost you for different services at Active Green and Ross, and at this one, and at that one, and at the dealer. And the first time I walked in there, I realized, you know, they actually don't advertise that their price is lower. If you actually care to look at all the different services that they list and the price for each one, they are a little bit higher than all the different places. And I thought to myself, well, that's a strange way to advertise. You're listing all the competitors' prices, which are better. But the truth of the matter is, I think they are banking on you to say, it must be that they're going to provide me with better service because they have training on my type of car, number one. And number two, to look at it and say, you know, the difference isn't that bad. They're pretty close, and therefore I'm willing to pay a premium in order to get the dealer's special knowledge and treatment of the car, the relationship, and so forth. So there is a concern that maybe this isn't the best way to advertise for another reason. That doesn't make it unethical. That just may make it poor strategy. Yeah?
Yeah, I don't think there's no problem whatsoever with advertising, because the advertising doesn't mean you're not going to get the same service. It's based on what your costs are. If you're paying a less secretarial rate, you have a lower office cost, you're in a small building, a lot of issues. A lot of factors turn into fact before you go any further. So basically, they might be able to do it at a lower hourly rate, the same work as any other firm.
Right, and that may well be so. The problem is that you don't necessarily get a chance to explain that to the customer. The customer is making a decision by seeing the ad. But let's take a look at the third one. Low and Lower LLP. I have very few opportunities to work with humor in this area of law, so wherever I can do it, I try. Low and Lower LLP advertises a flat, all-costs-included fee of $2,500 to draft personal wills for individuals of low net worth, and names a competitor who recently charged $7,000 to draft a personal will for an individual in that class. Is this acceptable?
No.
Why not?
Because it's comparative advertising.
What's wrong with comparative advertising?
No, it's just
why is it not permitted? What's unethical about it?
There is no it's not objective, it's totally subjective. I mean, you can't say, I'm not going to charge you X number of dollars. You're not comparing widgets here, you're comparing a service.
Mm-hmm.
Which can be subjective and nuance.
Right, it's not necessarily a clear comparison, or certainly the way you're making it out in the ad. That's one problem. What's another problem? Right, you don't know what their price actually is. You know of one case, assuming everybody's being honest, and this person actually existed. It was just potentially a one-shot case. You have no idea if that's their regular rate at all. You just know it happened once. Yeah.
You're trying to make yourself look good by making somebody else look.
So, right, so then there's another piece of this, right, which is you are putting them down, and it's not just a matter of benefiting at someone else's expense, but actively denigrating the other lawyer. So that's our third case. And then our last case. This is terrible, I had to. The marketing consultant for Will Drafters, Meany & Lauder LLP, recommends a new advertising strategy. A campaign of daily emails to cancer survivors, citing data on the frequency of relapse and including graphic imagery from hospital wards and funerals. Recipients are offered special deals, which are good for only 24 hours. Is this acceptable?
No.
No, not acceptable. Why not? No, why not?
Bad taste.
Bad taste, for sure. Yeah.
Preying on the vulnerable.
Right? Preying on the vulnerable is a specific concern in the realm of ethical advertising, and that's certainly what they're doing. Yes? So depending on how they got the names, right, there may be spam issues involved also. So I'll go back to my opening comment that you have to make sure to obey the law in general, having nothing to do with the law society's standards. But yes, the whole can spam thing is another issue. Okay. So let's go through first the reasons in favor of advertising and why we want there to be advertising from, again, a Jewish law perspective as well as the Law Society's perspective, and then work our way through the problems within both systems and address these particular cases. So first of all, access to justice was mentioned as a reason why lawyers should advertise. And the theory is straightforward. Society needs to ensure that all citizens are able to make use of the justice system. From the secular point of view, it's a practical issue and it's an ethical issue. You want society to function in a way that is fair. If you take a look at source number 3, this is from Chief Justice Nathan Nemitz from the Supreme Court of BC. It's quoted in a variety of cases. We have no doubt that the right to access to the courts is under the rule of law, one of the fundamental pillars protecting the rights and freedoms of our citizens. It's necessary. As part of protecting the rights of the citizens, people have to be able to make use of the justice system. It's fairly straightforward. There's also a good piece from Justice Beverly McLaughlin called The Challenges We Face. You can find it online. She talks about the unjust result of limited access to justice. That's in the secular system. Within Jewish law and Jewish ethics as well, this is an important value, but it has religious overtones. It's not simply the practical functioning of society and the protection of citizens, but it's a religious point making sure that people will have access to justice. And one source that makes it clear is source number 4 from the book of Vayikra, Leviticus. Take a look, please, where the Torah writes, V'chiyagurit chager v'artzachem lo sonu oso. When a stranger lives among you in your lands, do not abuse him. And the stranger is mentioned in particular because the stranger is vulnerable. The stranger doesn't know the ropes, doesn't have the connections. So don't abuse him. Kezrach mikem yelochem ager agar yitchem. He shall be as a citizen of yours, this stranger who lives among you. V'ahavta lo kamocha. You shall love him as yourself. Ki gerim eisem be'eretz Mitzrayim. You were strangers in Egypt. Ani Hashem Elokechem. I am Hashem your God. So we are told to make sure to protect this stranger. And God attaches his name, he signs his name, saying, I am God. And then the next verse, which is from a slightly different chapter in Leviticus, it's 5 chapters later, Mishpat Echad Yiyeh Lachem. You shall have one justice for all. Kager ka ezrach yeyeh, like stranger, like citizen. Ki ani Hashem Elokechem, for I am Hashem your God. And again, he signs his name to it. So the sages ask, why does God insist on signing his name, so to speak, at the end of these sentences? And one of the explanations that is offered is because God says when someone is vulnerable among you, you could probably get away with doing them wrong. You would be able to take advantage of their ignorance of the system or the fact that they don't have the connections. And therefore, God says, I am the one who's going to watch out. If you are going to harm the stranger, it's going to be it's something that I'm going to pay attention to, and ultimately, I am going to call you on it. So what you see within the Jewish system is the statement that the vulnerable have to be treated well, and specifically with one system of justice. We're not going to say there's one system for the citizens and then there's another system for the strangers. One system for all. That's on the theory level. On the application level, this issue of access to justice has many different applications. We're not going to do everything you could say about access to justice right now because, God willing, the class that I'm going to be doing in, I think, in May is actually on a pro bono work. And there we'll have to discuss access to justice as well, the question of whether there is a legal right to legal aid. So we'll talk about that there. But just speaking very very broadly, there is a concept on a practical level of access to justice. I brought you source number 5. This is put out by the Department of Justice. It's a piece called Expanding Horizons, Rethinking Access to Justice in Canada. And this is from the preface. For nearly 3 decades, access to justice has been a central policy issue within the Department of Justice. The early programs developed during the 1970s provided information about the law and how the justice system works, or assured representation in court for people who could not afford legal assistance. So that was already good, right? At that point, they're providing information about the law, and they're assuring that people will have representation in court. Early steps. But then they write, looking back, though, we can see that these programs took for granted a traditional form of justice that was largely formal and technical. The courtroom, the court system. Access was improved, But the problems that brought people into contact with the law were generally defined in narrow legal terms to be resolved only in court. But justice means more than simply applying the law without regard to the underlying social, economic, and psychological factors, as we have become increasingly aware in recent years. New ideas have entered the discourse, widening the scope of the concept and affecting the way we think of justice and of access to justice. It is not enough to treat access as solely a matter of courts and formal legal proceedings. There is a need for a broader system, a better system, for helping people find justice. And so, if you take a look in the rest of the paragraph here, I gave you a quote from page 11 of the report. In the last few decades, we've experimented with a variety of alternatives to our mainstream legal system in the forms of alternative dispute resolution, voluntary compliance, diversion from the criminal justice system, or creative processes for sentencing offenders. We've had much success with these efforts. They embolden us to move even further away from the centrifugal force of the legal system. So, what you see within the secular system is a conscious decision of we need to improve access, and that means broadening the options for people in terms of how they get justice, as well as making sure that they know about their options and they have representation. And that comes down to, in terms of our discussion tonight, advertising. And making sure that there is advertising. And if you take a look at source number 6, I thought this was really interesting, a paper called Legal Ethics in a Digital World, from the Canadian Bar Association. Aside from being a very valuable marketing tool, law firm websites can also serve as a public service to help promote access to justice. After all, quote, access to justice requires that the public have available, understandable information about the justice system, its resources, and means of access. Law firm websites have the potential to help individuals, quote, access justice by developing and disseminating information and materials as broadly as possible, forms and by means that can reach the largest possible number and variety of people. So they're actually telling you, go out and create a good law website. That's what they want you to do. They want you to have a website which will not only promote your practice, but will educate the public. That's that's one of the applications for access to justice. Jewish law, as we've already said, is concerned about access to justice and has parallels to these systems, parallels to what the secular system has done to enable access to justice. So one easy example is actually from the weekly Torah portion that's read this coming Shabbat, and that's source number 7. The context for source number 7 is that the Jews have gotten out of Egypt. They're on their way into, eventually going to get into the land that will become Israel. And they're joined by a man by the name of Yitro. In English they write it as Jethro. He is the father-in-law of Moshe, father-in-law of Moses. And like every good father-in-law, he shows up, sees what's going on, and gives advice. To which Moshe listens to his advice and sends him home. But my father-in-law might watch this video. I'm going to get in trouble. But he would not fit into that category. Anyway, he sees that Moshe is sitting in court and judging people the entire day. He's just hearing cases all day long. And Yitro says to him, "You can't do it. It's bad for the nation, and it's bad for you." And so he says, what you should do instead is appoint tiers of judges, so that there will be lower courts and then higher courts, and that way the nation's needs will be taken care of. If you take a look at source number 7, he says, "V'atasech ezemi kol ha'am." You should identify from the entire nation, Anshei Chayil, men of strength, Yirei Elokim, who revere God, Anshei Emet, men of truth, Sonei Batsa, people who hate profit, Visamta Alehem, and you should place over them, over the nation, Sarei Alafim, Sarei Meot, Sarei Hamishim, Sarei Asarot, officers over thousands of people, over hundreds of people, over groups of 50 and over tens, a hierarchy of officials and courts who will be able to hear cases, and that way there will be greater access to justice. And that was implemented in the Jewish world once we got into the land with the system of courts known as, the highest court was known as the Sanhedrin, but there were lower level courts as well, also called Sanhedrin. If you take a look at source number 8, you find a lesson from the Talmud. This goes back roughly 2,000 years, maybe a little bit more, describing what size city you need in order to warrant a court of 23 judges. The simple, quick explanation of this is that classically, the lowest level of court had 3 judges. They could hear standard financial cases, but they didn't have any of the really interesting powers of a court in terms of either various types of penalties that they wanted to give, in terms of the ability to hear capital cases. That's not a court of 3 judges. A court of 23 judges has those powers. And then there's the high court of 71 judges that sat in the temple in Jerusalem. But how big a population did you need in order to warrant a court of 23 judges? So take a look at source number 8. The Kama Yehe Be'iru Teheru Uyul Sanhedrin. How big does the city have to be to warrant this court of 23 judges? May have asked him, just 120 people. Every community of 120 people is going to have a court of 23 judges. You realize that that means that your court makes up more than 20% of your, roughly 20% of your city. But that's what we're saying here. And Rabbi Nechemiah disagrees. He says, no, 230 people. But there was an imperative of making sure that you would have courts. And not only that, the courts should be available to people at convenient times. So that courts classically convened on Monday and Thursday. Every Monday and Thursday, the courts would convene. Why Monday and Thursday? Torah reading. Take a look at, there is also market day on Monday and Thursday, and how that fits into it is an interesting question. But take a look at source number 9, where the Talmud writes, and this is supposed to be an enactment that actually goes back 2,500 years, V'danin b'sheni u'b'chamishi. The courts judge on Mondays and Thursdays. D'shchichi da'asu rabim da'asu l'mikra b'sifra. Because people are available as they come read from the Torah. Meaning they all gather into the city to have the Torah reading, which is traditionally done on Monday and Thursday. So this way they'll catch the Torah reading and they'll also be able to go to the courts. So we had this idea of making the courts available to the public, making sure there would be many courts, and making sure that they would be accessible. Further, just like we saw within the secular system, an imperative of trying to make sure that there are extrajudicial ways of dealing with things, the tribunals and so forth, we have within Jewish law the concept of pursuing compromise. Now last year we had a class on this, the sue or settle class, about whether you're supposed to pursue compromise initially or not. And what we said, and I brought you the source, in source number 10, the law in fact is that it is considered a mitzvah to pursue settlement before going to court. And that's something that is encouraged there. The reason isn't necessarily access to justice as much as because it's better for society as a whole. But that's an application of the idea of having options beyond the courts. We also were told to remove financial obstacles to make sure that people would be able to have access to justice. Didn't quite work the same way it does in the secular system, because in the secular system you have lawyers, and lawyers need to be paid. And the question is, how is someone going to pay the lawyer? Within the Jewish system, remember that traditionally you didn't have lawyers. There was such a thing as an oreich din. The term in Hebrew for a lawyer, oreich din, goes back to Talmudic times. However, the position of a lawyer who would represent people in court did not exist. And so you didn't have the concern of how is somebody going to pay a lawyer. However, you did have a concern that people who were less well-connected would not really be able to work with the system. And so various rules were meant to help people be able to take advantage of the legal system. So for example, if you take a look at source number 11, I'm going to state it outside of the text. I brought you the text so you would see it. But there is a law called Shvuat HaEdut, which says that if somebody comes to court with a claim against somebody else, the court issues a public oath declaring that anybody who knows testimony is obligated to come testify. They take the burden of finding witnesses off of the litigant. And they say if anybody knows testimony, they're obligated to testify, and if they don't, there are severe penalties for failing to show up and provide testimony. So it's a way in which we try to help with the litigant's access to justice. Yes?
One question on Jewish law. How many judges have to sit at one time? They have 23 judges with 120 or 230, whatever.
Yeah.
How many, according to the Sanhedrin, they sat as a group of 71. But when the smaller ports, the 23 honeys,
yeah, they all sit at one time. They have to be together, yes. So that's the, there was a whole system. If somebody had to leave, then how you replace them, like there's a system for it. It seems a little bit unwieldy. But that's the case. One last example of concern for access to justice is source number 12, in which we get an instruction. Biblical text says, Kakaton kagadol tishma'un. There's an imperative to the judges to hear the case of the small, just as they hear the case of the great. And Reish Lakish, one of the Talmudic sages, explained that what this means is, Shechaviv alecha din shal pruta ki din shal me'amana. The law of a pruta, the pruta is the smallest unit of currency recognized in the Talmud. It's equivalent to somewhere between 5 and 10 cents U.S., which is something else Canadian, I don't even know anymore. It's linked to silver, to the value of silver. So the statement he makes is, the law of any minimal amount, the pruta's worth, should be as beloved to you, and you should be as careful with it, as the law of 100 mana, which is a much larger unit, to which the Talmud then asks, Lamai Hilchasa, as far as what? If you're telling me you have to be careful and examine and rule properly, that's obvious. I didn't need a verse in the Torah to tell me, deal honestly no matter the size of the issue at hand. So they explain, rather, what it's saying is lagdume, in terms of putting it first. Meaning, you don't say, this person has a multi-million dollar deal, and this person has some small claim, so I'm going to move up the multi-million dollar deal on the docket. It doesn't work that way. All the litigants are treated equally. Came into court first, case will be heard first. Outside of certain cases where there's a public need in putting one first, but other than that. So that you see the imperative of access to justice both within the secular system and within the Jewish system in terms of removing financial obstacles, in terms of making sure the courts are available and that there are many courts, in terms of employing non-judicial solutions, and in terms of making information available. What you don't see within the Jewish system is a specific imperative of advertising, the way that you see it within the secular. That you don't really see within the literature. Okay, that's one. That's access to justice. That's reason one why we want lawyers to advertise. The second reason we want lawyers to advertise is because we want to promote a fair market. And here I'm going to invoke a term which is new to me as I was preparing for this class, and that's a term called credence goods. Anyone know what credence goods are? You ever hear the term? Okay, good. So I don't feel bad that I just learned it. Take a look at source number 13. This is what I found to be a good piece on it. From Middle Income Access to Justice. Purchasing a lawyer's services is an uncertain business. Law is both what economists term a credence good and what they term an experience good. The signal quality of a credence good is that consumers cannot evaluate providers' performance. Producers of credence goods identify and treat problems that their clients do not know how to solve and may not even recognize what they confront. Right? Law is a credence good. I, as a person who is using a lawyer, have no idea whether they did a good job or not. And it will not be determined based on whether I won or lost my case. Right? If you go with a very poor case to begin with, then you can't gauge the quality of the legal service based on what the result was. If your case was a no-brainer, you also can't say, well, we won. I guess that means that the lawyer is a better lawyer than the one on the other side. It doesn't work that way. It's a credence good, meaning that you have to trust that the person you went to is a professional and is going to do a good job. That's the idea of a credence good. And then, an experience good is one for which consumers cannot evaluate its quality prior to purchase, but for which they may be able to assess quality after purchase. Maybe. And as I said, not necessarily. So the point is that when we talk about wanting to promote a fair market, right now, without advertising, a fair market doesn't exist. Because it's very hard for people to make any sort of an assessment of the options that they have in front of them. So the theory is that it's in the best interest of society to ensure that its citizens are going to make efficient business decisions, and advertising is going to help them. There's one example I brought you in source number 14 from the UN on the importance of making sure that your consumers are able to make informed choices. I'm not going to go into it now. It's not directly relevant. But we do believe that it's important that citizens are able to make proper business decisions. And so, when it comes to application, we have this as well. We have applications of this desire for a fair system in the secular system, as well as under Jewish law. If you take a look at source number 15, number 15 comes from an article by Akiva Miller, who's a student at New York University. He's doing graduate work there, I believe. And he writes, it's called, "What Do We Worry About When We Worry About Price Discrimination?" He says, "We might also consider whether a rule requiring a seller to disclose her lowest price may not also be advisable as a precautionary rule under the other arguments of unfairness, consumer welfare, and antitrust. If those arguments are true, the best way to avoid those complaints would be to force the disclosure of a seller's lowest price, so that the seller would not be able to employ pricing strategies that consumers find unfair or unduly extract consumer welfare." Maybe this requires a little bit of explanation. What Miller is talking about is making sure that the rules of competition will balance between wanting a fair market and then, on the other hand, enabling competitors to survive. So Miller actually suggests that maybe what we should do is require people who are going to provide goods or provide services to name the lowest price that they will accept. That should actually be part of the advertising in order to beat some of the strategies that the sellers have to game the system. It's an interesting argument on behalf of consumers. I don't think it's going anywhere offhand. Right, it's very difficult to assess how this would be applied in practice. I'm more interested by the theory that he brings to bear, which is that sellers are able to do all sorts of things to balance the market in their favor, and then maybe there's a need to compensate for that by balancing things in favor of the consumer. And his argument is that information is the way to balance it in favor of the consumer. You're right. The particular strategy he's mentioning is very hard to envision applying in the case of legal services. Yes?
I just want to maybe check on this assumption that we're talking about here, that access to justice could be improved with increased advertising. I think if you want to draw a parallel between the private sector, a corporation that sells widgets, let's say, and legal services, usually what ends up happening is he or she who spends the most on advertising wins, right? So you have consumer companies that their products aren't necessarily the best, but they advertise the most. You see their products on the billboards, on the TV advertisements, the magazine advertisements. So the personal injury law firm A, has a $2 million advertising budget, and the little Joe Schmo guy on the street has a $1,000 advertising budget. Not necessarily access to justice, because people are going to choose maybe the personal injury firm because they see their billboards everywhere, plastered wherever you go, and they say, "Oh, these guys must be great, they're everywhere." So I think we've got to maybe check that assumption about access to justice.
Correct. And I would agree with you. In other words, what we're doing right now is presenting the arguments in favor of advertising, but there absolutely are concerns about how this is going to play out in practice. The particular concern for the large budget company being able to do more, right, and to advertise more, not just in law, but anywhere, but if we're dealing with access to justice. So in law, the large firm being able to promote more heavily actually has kind of a reverse effect that we're going to see. So, wait a little bit with that. But yes, this is absolutely a concern that we have to deal with. In terms of this idea of balancing out the disadvantage and making sure that there is a fair market system, I brought you a couple of cases just to show you how Jewish tradition has been concerned about exactly this issue. I brought you source number 16. There is a law that says that a woman who gives birth is supposed to bring a particular offering in the temple after giving birth. And if she has multiple children, then there are multiple offerings that she needs to bring. Well, in source number 16, what we find is that at one point, the people who owned the birds that were who were selling them to women who needed to bring offerings were gouging on the prices. They raised the prices. And so look what happened. Once, bird offerings in Jerusalem cost gold dinarim. A gold dinar, very expensive coin. It doesn't say exactly how many dinar. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel was one of the leading sages of the time, and he swore by the temple, I will not sleep tonight until they cost standard dinarim. I'm going to drive down the price. How did he do it? He entered the court, and he taught the following lesson. A woman who needs to bring offerings for multiple births or impurities brings one offering. He said, however many kids you had, it doesn't make a difference, you only bring one offering. Right? It's basic supply and demand. He has now killed the demand. He had leeway within the law and the debates about whether you need to bring one offering or more than one. He wasn't, you know, just inventing things. But he gave a lenient ruling that reduced the number of offerings that they needed to bring. And lo and behold, bird offerings dropped to a quarter dinar that day. He killed the market for the offerings. Centuries later, this would become very relevant in the somewhat prosaic case of, anybody know?
Pesach.
Nope, not Pesach, I wish. But close, gefilte fish. Someone said it, I heard it here somewhere. It happened in the case of gefilte fish. Going back to the 17th century, it may have happened earlier, but the earliest recorded case I'm aware of was in the 17th century, and then it happened repeatedly after that. The fish merchants knew that Jews would specifically try to have fish for their meals on Shabbat. There are all sorts of nice associations with fish that drove this. And so they hiked the price on fish. And so the rabbis issued a ban on eating fish on Shabbat. And that was it. And the price was driven down. Happened multiple times. Yeah. Go for it. Yeah. Yes. No, that's absolutely true. And, you know, what you mentioned in terms of the factors is just tip of the iceberg in terms of what the consumer wants and the information they need. The only purpose of the analogy is to show concern for wanting to promote a fair market. The application to legal services is where we're going. Yeah. That's our second imperative for advertising. Our first imperative for advertising is access to justice, a principle common to Jewish law and secular law. Our second principle is the desire for a fair market, also common to Jewish law and secular law. Are we clear on those points? There's actually a third point that I'm not going to go into, a third issue which is raised, which is the theory that advertising will increase competition and keep prices lower. That's an argument that was made initially, because remember, initially in Canada, you could not advertise legal services. And one of the arguments for changing it was it will benefit the consumer, because once prices are being advertised, they will then lower it. And also because as people have access to a larger base of customers, then they'll be able to spread out the costs of their larger base, and therefore they won't need to charge as much. However, that didn't actually work. I brought you source number 17. This Jacob Goffman, I think the paper was actually written at U of T's law school. It's a very good paper. In number 17, he writes, in fact, it has been found that price advertising has had a relatively paltry impact on decreasing the cost of legal services, even in countries with the most relaxed restrictions on price advertising, such as the United States. This is because a problem arises when price advertising is undertaken exclusively, or at least principally, by low-price, low-quality suppliers. And this is what I was alluding to before when I said that the effects of advertising are not necessarily what one would expect. In these circumstances, price advertising becomes an adverse signal on quality. The underlying reasoning being that consumers who are unable to assess quality in an ex ante or ex post manner, right, I have no idea how good the legal services are, and observe a low price for a non-standardized service, assume that more knowledgeable purchasers have assessed the services and concluded them to be of low quality. In other words, to make a long story short, when I see somebody advertise, when I look at, to use the example from before, when I look at the big personal injury firm that has, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars that they're spending on their ad campaigns, maybe I look at that and say, that's a sign that these aren't people I should be going to. I should be looking for somebody else. And in fact, that has been found in market research, that people sometimes will look at it as he puts it, an adverse signal. So sometimes you don't get the results that you expected. He quotes numerous studies to that effect. So I'm not going into the question of whether it will actually lower the prices, because the answer is it's not so clear cut. So what we have is from a practical and ethical perspective in general society and a religious perspective in Jewish law, a desire to make sure that there will be advertising. Despite this, despite these imperatives, we have concerns about inappropriate advertising, and that's what I want to shift to now. If you take a look at source number 18, this is the law I alluded to in the rule, I should say, that I alluded to in the beginning, governing legal advertising from the LSUC's Rules of Professional Conduct, the most recent version of it, Rule 4.2-1. A lawyer may market legal services if the marketing, A, is demonstrably true, accurate, and verifiable. What's the difference between true and accurate? I'm asking a room of lawyers. But what's the difference between true and accurate? Is there... Okay, don't know. So, no, it's precise, is what they mean by accurate. No. Okay. I thought this was interesting. Okay. Demonstrably true, accurate, and verifiable. B is neither, this is not multiple choice, by the way. B is neither misleading, confusing, or deceptive, nor likely to mislead, confuse, or deceive. So, number one, it has to be true and verifiably so. Number two, it can't mislead and it can't be likely to mislead. And then third, C, is in the best interests of the public and is consistent with a high standard of professionalism. Those are our requirements. So first of all, it can't convey untruth. The messages conveyed by the advertising must be, as they say here, true, accurate, and verifiable. That's the secular principle, Jewish law principle, source number 19. Midvar sheker tirchak, distance yourself from falsehood. Now, if you're a scholar of Jewish law, you will be aware that actually verse number 19 is understood to refer to a courtroom situation. Under oath, when you're testifying in court, you're not allowed to lie. It doesn't necessarily speak about day-to-day conduct. And that's why I brought you source 20 and source 21. The message in the source number 20, a passage from the Talmud, is when you say yes, it has to mean yes. When you say no, it has to mean no. A person has to be sincere in her statements. And then in number 21, we get the very strong statement, God despises three types of people. One, hamadaber echad bepeh veechad b'lev, a person who speaks one way with his mouth and another with his heart. If you're saying one thing but thinking another, that's considered to be despicable behavior. The other two are really separate topics, but a person who knows testimony and declines to testify. And then third, someone who witnesses impropriety by somebody else and testifies alone, because the Jewish system requires two witnesses in order to testify. And if you only have one, all they're doing is spreading bad messages about somebody, but because there's no other witness, nothing can be done about it, and therefore it's considered improper. It's better to seek out a second witness and then testify together. But the point is that we're saying that there's absolutely an imperative in the secular system and in the Jewish law system to ensure that you testify, that you advertise honestly. That's number one. Number two, giving bad advice. Giving people bad advice. So within the advertising description, the advertising rule, I should say, in source number 18, your advertising has to be in the best interests of the public, right? It has to serve their interests. It cannot be something that will mislead people. Within Jewish law, source number 22, the key line there, Lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, do not put a stumbling block in front of the blind. Do not mislead people. Source number 23 gives you an example. If someone asks you for advice, don't give them advice in a way that's inappropriate for that person. Don't say, go out in the early morning, such that thieves will attack him, and so on and so forth. So we have a principle of not giving bad advice. That's number two. Those are both common to both systems. But then we get to some concerns that are not common to both systems. One is the concept called in Hebrew, ona'at devarim. Best translation, verbal abuse. Is probably the best translation of ona'at devarim. If you take a look at source number 24, a passage from the Mishnah, the building block of the Talmud, is a couple of thousand years old, and it deals with something that people do all the time. Kishem sha'ona'a b'mekachum emkard, source 24. Just as there are rules about commercial abuse, meaning that you're not allowed to defraud somebody, overcharging, that sort of thing, kach ona'a b'dvarim, so too, there is such a thing as verbal abuse. Lo yomar lo, you shouldn't go up to the owner of an item and say to him, "Bekama chefet zeh, how much does this item cost?" V'hu eino rotzeh likach, when you don't want to buy it. Can't go up to the prospective seller, at any rate, and say to him, "How much is this?" when you have zero interest in purchasing it. I'm not talking about where you're curious, because you may want to buy it, you don't know. But I'm talking about where you have zero interest. So you have no business doing this to the seller. Why not? Sorry?
We get his hopes up making the sale, and if he ever had any intention of buying,
you get his hopes up, right. You're going to get his hopes up. Now the truth is, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Take a look at source number 25. Right, Menachem Meiri, writing in 13th century France, expands this a little bit and explains it a little bit further. And he says, Asur lahonosis chaveiro, one may not abuse another person, v'ligrom lo pseida bidvarav, causing him loss with his words. V'usha amar, lo yomar lo bekamache v'tzeb, hu eino rotzeh likach, meaning, as we say here, you shouldn't say to him, how much does the item cost, when you don't wish to buy it? And it continues to explain. Because he is embarrassed to say that he doesn't wish to buy, meaning this prospective consumer who asks, how much does this cost? But he doesn't really intend to buy it. So what happens? He goes up to the seller. He says, how much is the item? The seller says, $100. Now he needs a way to walk away without coming off looking like he can't afford $100 perhaps. So what does he do? He instead degrades the merchandise. He says, it's not worth $100. True or not true, that's what he's going to say. And other people are going to hear it, and then they're not going to buy. So it's not only the emotional impact, it's also a financial impact. But then he continues to say, even if no one is present, still he strains the merchant and causes him pain, for he expects to sell, and he doesn't sell. You are harming the feelings of the seller. That's the concern in this case. Now, there's a lot to discuss about this in a broader business ethics context, and not really where I'm going to go with this evening, but the question of the standard practice of browsing in a store, which everybody does, versus the question, actually, I'll be speaking on the topic of showrooming at a lunch and learn at Miller Bernstein, for anyone who's interested, on February 10th. The topic of showrooming. Anyone know what showrooming is? Showrooming is, you thought you were here for credits, but lo and behold, you get a new word. Showrooming is where you go to a store to look at an item, try it out, price it up, all for the sake of buying it online, knowing full well that that's what you intend to do. So that's called showrooming. You've turned the store into a showroom. Maybe call being smart also, but it may not be allowed within Jewish law, hence the luncheon. In any case, the Yeah, well, but it's not just window shopping. Because you're going to talk to the person in the store, and you're going to ask them to show you the item and to explain its different points and how it's used. It's more than that. And the stores are powerless to do anything about it. But in any case, the concern for verbal abuse, not the way we usually think of it, but using your speech in order to give somebody a bad feeling, in order to hurt their feelings, is a concern within Jewish law. I do not know of any parallel within the secular system, certainly within the rules that are given here by the Law Society that we saw in 4.2. There was nothing there that said legal advertising shouldn't hurt anybody's feelings. I didn't see that there. That's something that will be a uniquely Jewish concern. Yes? So I think that's fine. In other words, you're not getting his hopes up for nothing. It might be a good idea to be upfront about it. Yes? Right. So what some businesses have done is taken the approach of if you can't beat them, join them. And yeah, that's one tactic. Another tactic is the Amazon app. In which you're able to actually see the price for it. You just enter it there. You scan it at the store, and then you can see what it costs, which caused a burst of showrooming that caused problems on the other. There's a whole back and forth in terms of the marketing techniques that have gone on ever since this became a thing. But that's our third concern, is the emotional abuse or verbal abuse concern. Go for it.
Jewish law is, I think, really made by Jews and how we practice.
Okay.
It's unrealistic in the 21st century to believe that we are somehow breaking a Torah law by going to Walmart and looking at an item and determining whether I want to buy it at Walmart or whether I want to go and buy it. On the internet.
Right.
So, if the standard practice of all the Jews now is to only bring one word for a offering, then that's the standard practice of the Jews now. Not unlike kittens.
So, I think that where the analogy falls apart that you're making is that you have biblical principles that are applicable here. In other words, the biblical principles of not harming the feelings as well as business of others are well established. When the biblical text says, "Velo tonu isha damito," don't oppress each other, this is just an application of a biblical rule. It's not a matter of what's our custom. It's a matter of does the biblical verse that says, "Don't oppress others," apply here or not. And I think to my mind, the statement that if you go into someone's store and start asking about his product and lead him into a whole discussion and so forth, thank you. You're anticipating more questions from that direction. In the event that you lead him through this whole routine, knowing you don't plan at all to.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You're simply you're what you call shopping.
Showrooming.
I'm missing that in this day and time the application.
Right. No. The question of whether it'll. Right. No. The question of whether it'll apply if you're dealing with someone who isn't a proprietor, but instead is just somebody being paid by the hour to work in the store, is a good question. Am I really oppressing him? Am I hurting his feelings? The answer may be no. But the fundamental concept that you are harming the proprietor of the business if you lead him around like this, I think is still a valid one, separate from the question about, let's say, the Best Buy person who's working in the store is going to get paid regardless. That may be a different story. Yeah?
Well, why would it make any difference if he's a proprietor or not? Even if he's an employee, you're taking his time away from serving other customers. His performance suffers because you're sitting there serving somebody who has absolutely no interest in purchasing the product.
Right. So that may be a separate question. The question of whether I am in fact doing violence to the business, so to speak, by taking their time in this way. That's not even an issue of hurting somebody's feelings as much as it's a question of did I steal from them.
I would argue the opposite way. I would say it's even worse. Because this person, his livelihood comes from the way he impresses his boss in this performance. He gets his performance review. If he's spending all of his day with people who are doing nothing but wasting his time, at the end of the day, it could affect his price up.
The argument could definitely be made. I'm going to go a little further with this and just hold the questions on this because, while it's a great topic, I want to make sure to get through the advertising. We haven't gone back to our four cases yet. I'm willing to stay here and discuss at the end, so don't go away. But that was the third concern. The concern for this sort of abuse of the seller in the case there, or in the case that we're going to talk about, the person seeing the advertising. The fourth concern, there are five total, the fourth concern is aggressive pursuit of profit, which again, secular law doesn't seem to be a big deal. Go for it. However, within Jewish law, there actually is a concern for something which the best approximation in secular law is harassment. Would probably be the best term to use for it. In other words, harassing somebody into making a sale or harassing somebody into becoming a client. And that is a concern that comes under a biblical law. It's actually also found in this coming week's Torah portion. The law of lo tachmod. Lo tachmod means do not covet, right? Do not desire the property of the others. So there's actually, as authorities in Jewish law understand it, there's no prohibition against desiring somebody else's property. The violation is if you not only desire it, but take steps to force that person to make it yours, or take steps to try to steal it. That would also be under this prohibition. If you take a look at source number 26, Rabbi Yosef Karo, author of the Shulchan Aruch, writes, Kol hachomeid, one who desires another person's servant, maid, home, implement, or anything that he's able to purchase from that person. V'ichbid alav re'im, v'ivsirbo achalak chomimenu. And you know he doesn't want to sell, so you bring a whole bunch of friends over and say, push him to sell it to me. And you start badgering him, until finally he says, enough already, I'll sell it to you. Even though you pay him for it, no theft is going on. Nonetheless, hareza over below tachmot. That is a violation of the biblical prohibition against coveting somebody else's property. There's some discussion about whether it's one violation, multiple violations, but fundamentally, I am not allowed to badger somebody else into selling me something. Now, that doesn't seem to apply to legal advertising until you realize that if I'm not allowed to badger somebody to sell me his goods, I'm also not allowed to badger him into buying mine. What am I coveting in that case? His money. Well, I'm coveting his money. I want his money. And the way I'm going to get it is by pushing him to buy my goods or to buy my service until he's going to pay me. If you take a look at source number 27, Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, who passed away a couple of years ago, but was a leading rabbi in Beit Din, in a religious court in Israel, wrote, I have seen, I'm going to read out in the English in the interest of time at this point, but he said, I have seen one who wrote that the same rule applies for one who pushes another to buy from him. It involves the prohibition against chamas. Chamas, literally, as a Hebrew word, refers to taking things by force. So that's what you've done here. And he says, his words appear to be correct. That appears to be a correct view, that from a Jewish law perspective, you can't harass somebody into selling you something. I think from a secular law perspective, there's nothing wrong with that. As long as you obey the rules about what hours you can call their home and how you got their information and so forth, I think you're allowed. I get, I don't know how many postcards and letter type things in the mail every day from real estate people who want to know, do you want to sell or buy a home? There's no law against it. From a Jewish law perspective, that may be something to think about. Yes? Yeah.
One of the advertising requirements is that in this place I
Good.
And so, like, the badgering, the baiting, the abusing, I mean, in my book anyway, I don't think that would be consistent with a high degree of professionalism.
Excellent. So that brings us to the last of the five issues. Our first issue was making sure it's honest. Our second issue was making sure it's not misleading. I'm giving some, or, you know, giving person bad advice. And those are common to both the Jewish law system and the secular system. Then we had two issues that are specifically Jewish. The concern for hurting the person's feelings and the concern for harassment. And then you get the fifth issue, which really is a concern found only in the secular writing, but not in the Jewish law writing. And that is the concern about cheapening the image of the profession. And there, we already saw the requirement that it be professional. And here I come back to what I said in the beginning, when I asked you how many of you believe that advertising actually influences people's perception of the legal profession. So take a look at source number 28 from that same paper by Goffman. He says, indeed, studies have shown that the traditional normative justifications given by those in the legal profession, meaning justifications for not advertising, do not comport with the realities of consumer perception. In an ABA national survey, advertising was found to not be a major factor in shaping public impressions of the bar. Moreover, dignified advertisements were found to reflect favorably on the profession. Of the surveyed American states, over 90% of all complaints about advertising came from other lawyers, while only 1 to 2% of consumers' complaints about lawyers involved advertising. So number one, the complaints about advertising are coming from other lawyers. And number two, the things that consumers are complaining about are not the ads. So that's injecting a little bit of fact into the conversation. Nonetheless, it is clear that 4.2-1 says your ads have to be professional. And they can't detract from the reputation of the practice of law. We have a similar concept in Jewish law, not in terms of the practice of law, because again, lawyers aren't in the system that's envisioned and described Talmudically. But what you have it is in terms of Torah scholarship. I brought you source number 29, which speaks about how it is a terrible sin for a Torah scholar to go out with a stain on his clothing. And you see the language there. It's very harsh language because of the concern for how it reflects on the profession, so to speak. How it reflects on Torah study. What kind of a person is this? That's the concern that you find within the practice of law in the secular system. So we have the joint concerns of lying and bad advice. We have the Jewish concerns for harassment and aggressive pursuit of profit. I'm sorry, for hurting the person's feelings and harassment. And then we have the secular concern about the professionalism of the profession. So now, balancing these two sides against each other, let's go back to our initial cases. Our first case was, if you go back to number two, advertising will preparation services when actually all this firm does is refer them away to others. So at the time when we started this an hour ago and I asked the question of whether this is appropriate or not appropriate, there were concerns expressed in terms of whether it's misleading and whether you have to, I think someone said, you have to inform them not in the ad, but before they're going to hire you. Another view was, no, it actually has to be within the ad. So there is a major concern for transparency with the public in this regard. If you take a look at source number 30, this is from that article I quoted initially in the Law Times. Mercer says, one broader issue that right or wrong is worthy of consideration is an increase in lawyers who pay referral fees to other lawyers who provide them with cases and how those firms advertise. There has been concern expressed that some of the referral fees are not a percentage of the ultimate recovery, but are flat rates, he says. The concerns of those who raise that issue are that the result may be the referring lawyer isn't interested in getting the file to the lawyer who can do the best job, but to the lawyer that's prepared to pay the highest fixed fee. It's worthy of examination how the referral fee system has evolved to reflect the question, is this a system that is transparent, that is aligned with client interests, or not? In other words, if the client doesn't know in advance that this is a bird dog, that they are just finding customers for other firms, if the client doesn't know that, then the client may well sign on, end up being referred somewhere else, and even though they'll know that there's a referral fee being paid, they won't know on what basis this is done and whether this is in fact in their best interests. So that the Law Society actually is against this. If you take a look at source number 31, 31 is simply the rule that says that you have to make sure the client is informed about the referral fee and the client has to consent. But if you take a look, actually, not in there, take a look in 32, that's what I had wanted, the commentary to rule 4.2. Examples of marketing that may contravene this rule, the rule of appropriate advertising, include A, stating an amount of money that the lawyer has recovered for a client or referring to the lawyer's degree of success in past cases. I'm going to skip that for the moment because it's not what's directly relevant right now. You know what? It's not in here. I thought that it was, but it's not. The commentary does not actually say you can't be a referrer. It's only in 4.2 that says that you can't be misleading. That was where it may come into play. But it does seem like as long as the client knows before the referral is done, under the current rules, they'd be able to advertise in this way. It is one of the items under concern, as the Law Times article reflects. The second case that we gave was the issue of naming a price. And we talked about, again, this was back in source number 2, the marketing slogan, "We will beat anyone's hourly fee to draft your will." And let's say that not only that, but you cap the number of hours that you're going to work, or you make sure we'll do it faster than everybody. Is there anything wrong under what we've said with naming a price? Based on what we've said.
Nothing wrong with naming your price
in the ad. Nothing wrong with naming the price in the ad. Any disagreement?
Your own price.
So you're correct. Currently, the law indeed allows it. What they don't like is the demeaning of others, and that's why I invoked the commentary. The 32E, on source number 32, but letter E, disparaging or demeaning other persons, groups, organizations, or institutions. Now, I don't think naming someone else's price is demeaning. It might be unprofessional, depending on how it's done. It might be demeaning, depending on how it's done. We're not like the other firms that are going to waste your time and take your money and not answer your calls or whatever. That's demeaning. Saying our price is better than others is not necessarily demeaning, and if it's done properly, it may not even be unprofessional. That would seem to be an acceptable thing to do. So, being the bird dog, from Jewish law, I suspect disclosure would be required. Secular, at least currently, would seem to allow it as long as the client knows by the time he gets to the by the time he gets to this stage of the referral. Unless you're going to argue the ad is misleading, in which case the secular system will not allow it. It could be argued the ad is misleading because you said you're going to draft their will, and in fact you're not. So there, I'm not so sure. When it comes to naming a price, it seems like it is indeed allowed as long as it's done in a professional way. The third case was the case of deceptive comparisons, where you say we're going to charge this, and that other firm charged somebody more, which isn't a statement about what they're always going to charge. It isn't a statement about what they already always charge. It's about one particular case, and you don't know, the customer doesn't know the specifics of the case. In that case, what will the secular rule say? Can't do it. Can't do it. It's misleading. And Jewish law is going to say the same thing. One would not be allowed to mislead the customer with this sort of advertising. I brought you in source number 33. It's not a legal advertising case. It's advertising a cow. So it's not the same thing. But but nonetheless, Rabbi Yochanan said, if one sells a cow and says, this cow gores, bites, kicks, and sprawls, identifies four defects, and it only has one of those defects in truth, which he stuck into the list of the other, with the other three.
and then he sells it on that basis, and then the customer comes back and says, hey, I didn't know it would do such and such. I bought this by mistake. So the rule, in fact, is that the customer is right. Because if you list one defect with three things that aren't defects, the customer looks at the list, says, well, I don't see this one in it. I don't see this one in it. And the other is probably not such a big deal either. And if he happens to pick the wrong defects to test, then he's going to end up buying it. So you have deceived the customer even as you said something that was entirely true. So you have this as a consideration within Jewish law as well. And then finally, the last case, taking advantage of the vulnerable, right? Targeting ads to people who are survivors of a particular illness and trying to prey on their fears of relapse. So there, I think it's relatively clear that yes, that would not be acceptable. Going back to number 32, the commentary to Rule 4.2-1, I think that comes in under F, taking advantage of a vulnerable person or group, and therefore the law society would not allow it. And from a Jewish law perspective, we wouldn't allow it either, both because, well, primarily because it is the issue of harming somebody else's feelings. Whether it comes under harassment or not, I'm not sure, but certainly under the issue of onad devarim, of making this person feel bad. So what we said, sorry? G also would apply. Oh, making emotional appeals. Maybe. I'm not so sure. I think emotional appeal sounds to me more like, you know, think of what your children are gonna, you know, are gonna do after you. That kind of, I think that's the emotional appeal. Maybe having the funeral thing in the brochure maybe over the top in the emotional appeal department. Could be. So to sum up what we said that number one, there are two reasons why we want to promote advertisement: access to justice as a secular value as well as a Jewish value, which has applications in both the secular field in terms of broadening the options for people, making sure to remove financial obstacles, making sure they can get to court, as well as within the Jewish system, wanting to make sure also that there are courts available and so forth. So access to justice says, let's make sure to advertise and let everybody know what their options are. Second is the issue of promoting a fair market, making sure that people know, again, what they can do, and they know what their options are, and hopefully that will lead to smarter business decisions. Despite this, we have concerns about potentially conveying something that is not true. We have concerns about giving people bad advice and misleading them. We have concerns in Jewish law about verbal abuse and harassment. And then we have concerns from the secular side with cheapening the image of the legal profession. Whether advertising actually does that or not stands on its own. So applying that to our cases, advertising services when you're actually just a bird dog, I think from a Jewish law perspective will definitely require disclosure. From a secular perspective, I think it's dicey, but likely it will be required, but I can't say that 100%. I think it does come under misleading, but I can't prove it. The issue of naming a price is allowed as long as it's done in a professional way from a secular perspective. From a Jewish law perspective, it'll be fine as well, as long as it's honest. Deceptive comparisons will be prohibited under both systems, and taking advantage of the vulnerable will also be prohibited under both systems. If anyone has to go now, that's fine. Make sure, please, that you signed in so that we'll know that you were here. I will send out a follow-up email with a digital version of the source sheet and so on, but I'm staying around to answer questions, so yes.
You didn't, two questions, somewhat related. You didn't mention the word puffery at all.
Right.
And my second question is, who are you trying to protect? Do you use the word consumer? Do you use the word people? Who are we trying to protect?
Right.
The person who needs legal services.
Right. So I think realistically, if people who are going could just keep it down a little bit so that we can hear the questions. My understanding of puffery, to go back to your first question first, my understanding of puffery is that it fits under misleading.
Puffery is a statement that no reasonable person would believe it's true. It's not misleading, but no one believes it. You say you're the best rabbi.
it's true. There is precedent within Jewish business ethics for claims which everybody understands to be, as you're calling it, puffery. There is precedent for accepting it and saying that that's not going to be a problem. Yeah, if I could ask that people just keep it down in the back. Thank you. Yes, as long as it's a claim that everybody knows isn't true, I think you're okay.
Well, the Combines Act will not prosecute puffery.
Okay. I mean,
so... Federal standard.
Right.
Not the Law Society. It's
right.
Federal standard.
Okay. I mean, the Law Society may create its own rules with it. I don't know. I haven't seen literature on what they do with puffery in particular. But from a Jewish law perspective, if it's clearly not misleading, it would be allowed. If it's clearly something that everybody else understands. In terms of the second question that you asked, which I'm trying to remember.
Who is the person?
Right.
Just the reasonable person on the omnibus?
Right. So I wouldn't say it's least common denominator, but it's close. In other words, my responsibility is not only to make sure that an educated customer will pick up on what's going on. My responsibility is to make sure that I do not mislead the non-educated customer, the customer who doesn't know better. I don't have to worry about every last person, but I am required to worry about just above that. Yeah. Yes, I think so. Yes, and then...
Here's a curveball, okay?
Uh-oh.
In Roman law, there is the principle of caveat emptor.
Yeah.
Meaning, satisfy yourself. What about if you know that something has defects, but you say nothing about it? You say nothing, and you put the product out.
Right.
You know?
Right.
For example, you advertise a certain service, and... You basically say nothing about it.
Right.
I guess it's easier when you wear an object that you can measure than something that you can it's a service that is more subjective. Right. You see, is that allowed or not allowed?
Right, so from a Jewish law perspective, there is an assumption that the customer makes.
Right.
We talk about a product before we talk about a service.
Right.
When you're talking about a product, the assumption is that by putting something up for sale, it is the type of item that is normally sold. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the same principle applies in Canada's Consumer Protection Act. It's the same rule. Sorry? The Goods and Services Act, thank you. Right, so express warranty is a piece of the picture, but that's not express warranty, it's implied. But what I'm talking about is actually that a person who puts an item up for sale is making a declaration that this is the normal standard of item, assuming it's in a commercial context. If it's a garage sale, then we don't apply the same rule in the secular system. It's only if it's in a commercial context. Right. So that's in terms of that. In terms of the service, I think it gets a little more tricky. Let's say, for example, somebody comes to me and says, let's pretend I was a lawyer, right? And says to me, I need the following, for my taxes, whatever it is, I got a letter from the CRA, they're reviewing, and I need you to do X. And I, as a lawyer, know that actually what he needs is not X. What he needs is something else. But I'm going to let him pay me to do X, and then he's going to have to come back to me for something else. So I am providing a service that I know he doesn't really need. That's the curveball, I think, because you'll say, well, I didn't say anything. My suspicion is that that's not going to be allowed. Yes?
You can't deceive by
I suspect not, because he's really relying on you.
I give you a very specific example. Something that happens in my practice. I practice in the area of immigration law, and I see routinely that people come in with work permits, and I say, well, how come you got this work permit that is only for a year, when in fact you could have gotten three?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Also, my previous lawyer didn't tell me, or somebody else got it, whatever, right?
Yeah.
So the question is that I believe at least that's what I do, that you're obligated to make them aware that there's a possibility that instead of applying for a work permit for a year and then have the person come back and need another one, you have to tell them, look, I mean, it's possible to get three.
Right. I mean, from a Jewish law perspective,
let them decide.
From a Jewish law perspective, you are going to be required to inform him,
right,
because it's putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. He doesn't have the information to make an educated decision. I believe from the secular perspective as well. That's my understanding. Yeah. Okay. Right. No. My point isn't to say what Jews do versus what others do. My point is to say that the Jewish law system has, for example, the law against harassment, whereas the Law Society has no such rule. Unless it makes lawyers look unprofessional, the Law Society says harassment is just fine. That's what I'm saying. I'm not talking about what Jews do versus what non-Jews do. Okay. Can I give you the phone number for the air duct cleaning guys?
Yeah, a lot.
Yes.
So
yes.
The
Jewish
law
system
is
not
the
same
as
the
of the law firm, and you call that all I'm doing is reporting, I'm not doing anything. Are you saying that that's okay?
So what I'm saying is that from a Jewish law perspective, I believe one is not allowed to do it because it is misleading. Right now, the way the law is written, the way the rule is written, 4.2-1 and the commentary on it, the argument could be made, and I think that's what the Law Times article is pointing out, the argument could be made that it's acceptable. I personally believe it isn't.
I think it's just classic bait and switch.
So it appears to me, but if you look at the wording, as long as you are not going to take them to this without having informed them, the argument could be made that it's that the Law Society will not be able to punish you for it. I right. I guess the question fundamentally is whether this constitutes something misleading, right? The question is, when I, as a client, go to a lawyer who says they're going to write my will, and then instead they send me to somebody else who I understand to be perfectly competent, do I feel like I was misled? I guess that's the fundamental question. If it's not going to cost me any more, and I think I'm getting good services, and I do get good services, then have I been misled at all? I think their argument, the argument of those who do this, is going to be that it's not misleading, and therefore it's okay. Again, I think it's a problem, but I think that the way that it's currently written, someone could probably get away with it. We got two hands. Leia, and then...
Okay, Rabbi, I very, very respectfully disagree with you.
Go for it.
But I may be reading it way too closely.
Yeah.
That the Law Society rule says a lawyer refers the matter to another licensee because of the expertise and ability of the other licensee to handle the matter. And the referral was not made because of conflict of interest. The referring lawyer may accept and the other licensee may pay a referral fee. So first of all, I think it's only dealing with the fact that there's a fee involved. But second, I think that if the reason for the referral is not because the other licensee is more expert in the matter, but is because there's a financial arrangement that, you know, Mr. Big is going to advertise and Mr. Medium Size and Mr. Small are going to do all the work, I don't think that comes under this category. And as I say, I may be reading it entirely closely, but it may be that the Law Society rule is addressing acceptable reasons for a referral, and financial gain of Mr. Big is not one of them.
Right, but what I brought there, 3.6-6, is not a problem of advertising. It's a question of the ethics of referring. It's a separate issue. In other words, what they're saying is, even where it's entirely upfront and everybody knows, nonetheless, I have to make sure the referral is done to somebody who's actually going to do the job well. I don't have the option of referring to my cousin. you know, just because he's my cousin. If he happens to be good at it, then there's a conversation. But that's the point. 3.6-6 only says that that referrals have to be done properly. It doesn't speak to the question of how I advertise that I am a referral service rather than a law firm. That's where this becomes an issue.